The question that I'd like to deal with today is a question that has been asked over the centuries by many different people and continues to bother many people today. When you look at Judaism, many people see in Judaism just hundreds, thousands of laws, nitpicking details, don't do this, don't do that, do this, do it now, 923, etc., etc. And people are overwhelmed. 613 commandments, 248 obligations, 365 prohibitions. Now, I usually do tell people not to be too overwhelmed, because unless you are male, female, single, married, divorced, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, all simultaneously, you're not obligated in all 613. No doubt in California you have communities like this, but for the vast majority of us, we're not obligated in all 613, but nevertheless, it does seem to be a tremendous amount of law, and it is something which in the New Testament referred to as the curse of the law, and there have been Jewish philosophers throughout history who've looked at these laws as preventing people from leading a good life. So I'd like to try to explain two things. First of all, what is the purpose of the mitzvot? What are they standing out to do? What do they intend to do? What is their purpose? And secondly, by what methodology do they seek to accomplish this purpose? So if you have a look at the outline, it's very important to have the outline. This will be on the finals at the end of the end of the seminar. Count to 10% of your marks. The first is very famous, the Medrash Rabbah in Bereshit in Genesis. The Medrash says the following. It says the mitzvot were given in order to refine humanity. In Hebrew, the commandments were given to l'tzaret. What does the word refine mean? The Hebrew word siruf actually has two different meanings. Siruf on the one hand means to refine, to remove impurities, as you would refine silver. It also means, l'tzaret also means to join together, as in soldering. So the commandments are supposed to do both. First of all, refinement. We believe that the human being is born with a need for refinement. This is expressed beautifully by a famous story in the Gemara. Rabbi Akiva is confronted by Turnus Rufus, a Roman. Turnus Rufus comes to Rabbi Akiva and he says to him, what is better, the deeds of God or the deeds of man? What he meant to do was to attack Judaism for the practice of circumcision, as if we are trying to improve on the work of God. So Rabbi Akiva says to second mate, go to the fridge, I don't know if he was Australian, but he probably spoke like that. He went to the fridge and he comes out with a stalk of wheat and a beautiful three-layer chocolate mousse cake. White chocolate, dark chocolate, cream, etc. Maraschino cherries, little shavings on, anyway. So, I'm okay now, alright. So he brings out the chocolate, he brings out the stalk of wheat, and he says to Turnus Rufus, which is better, deeds of God raise the stalk of wheat, deeds of man shows him the chocolate mousse cake. So Turnus Rufus, I mean, even if you're an ardent vegetarian, right, you do not take a stalk of wheat and eat it, right? What you have to do to a stalk of wheat is a tremendous amount of refinement. So Turnus Rufus admitted, yeah, he says the cake, the deeds of man, seem to be better. Rabbi Akiva was illustrating to him exactly the concept of what Judaism is about, which is the world is not the best of all possible worlds. It is not the best of all possible worlds, Dr. Pangloss says. Rather, it is a world which is the best world to be refined. It is the best world for refinement. And the human being, just like the stalk of wheat, needs refinement. To get from the stalk of wheat to the cake requires many steps, many, many different steps. And you always imagine, right, who was the person that thought of this? Some guy a few thousand years ago walked into a field of wheat and he said, wow, if you cut this down, whack it with a stick, rip off all the seeds, smash them, turn them into powder, mix them with water, throw it into the oven, it should take growth. Right? It's not the type of thing that instinctively you'd imagine. But indeed, the only way you can eat wheat is that way. That's what you have to do. The human being needs refinement. We are born imperfect and we need perfection. So the commandments are out to refine us, to perfect us, to remove impurities, to increase the good qualities, joining with surrender. We are born imperfect and we need perfection. So the commandments are out to refine us, to perfect us, to remove impurities, to increase the good qualities. Join, Lutzaret also means to join. The commandment, the purpose also, is to join us to higher levels of meaning. That we should not go through life merely on the level of existence. We have to go through life on the level of meaning. Viktor Frankl pointed out in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, that the most essential need of a human is not food or comfort, rather it is meaning. And that is another aspect of the commandment, is to give us an attachment to a level of existence which is not survival, but it's beyond survival, it's meaning. So that's the first idea. The commandments were given to refine, to improve us, to perfect us, and were given to join us to higher levels of meaning, higher levels of reality. Number two, the Sifrei Kedoshim, also quite famous, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel said, a person should not say, I do not like meat and milk mixtures. As you know, the Torah prohibits the eating of meat and milk cooked together. And the Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is telling us, a person should not say, I don't like it. Rather, they should say, I'd like it. But I do not have it because God prohibited it. What does he mean to say here? What should be our attitude? I walk by a restaurant and I see a Philadelphia cheesesteak or chicken Kiev, drop on them, but I see these things, veal parmesan, right, etc. And I say, what should I say? Ah, disgusting! It's meat and milk! Or should I say, that looks good and it smells good. And some of my students tell me it tastes good, right? And I should look at this and say, well, I'd like that. But no, I'm not going to have it because God said not to. So Rav Shimon ben Gamliel is saying that I should desire it. Very strange. So what's the explanation here? I think he's giving us an educational direction here. I remember first time I read my children, great classic of English literature, Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. I'm sure you studied in college in the United States. And so, first time I read it to my children, growing up in Har Nof in Jerusalem, the first question they asked me is, Abba, what's ham? Interestingly enough, they never asked me what green eggs are. Somehow in the child's mind, that's okay. Either that or it's the school cafeteria. But anyway. But they ask you, what's ham? So I say, ham is the meat of the pig. And their first reaction, you can guess, is, ugh! I say, it's not ugh. They say, what do you mean it's not ugh? I say, 1 billion Chinese can't be wrong. Right? And I say, what do you mean? I say, look, there are plenty of people who eat it, and it's fine. They like the taste. They like the aroma. They like the way it looks. I say, well, why don't we eat it? I say, we don't eat it. Not because we have an aversion to the taste. The commandments, the mitzvahs, are not meant to be instinctive. They're not meant to be that I just have an instinctive hatred for meat and milk or for ham. Rather, they're meant to instill in us consciousness, thought. It's a decision, it's not instinct. I don't want to raise kids who, when they grow up in life, just have an instinct, ugh, it must be disgusting. It must taste horrible. First of all, that's not correct, intellectually dishonest to teach them that, just not true. And secondly, that's not the motivation for not eating ham. The motivation is not because it doesn't taste good. The motivation is because for whatever reason, which we're not going to go into now, for whatever reason, the Torah forbids it. So that, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, I believe, is telling us that the commandments are out to instill in us consciousness and thought and decision-making as opposed to instinct and gut reactions. Number three, Maimonides, the Mishnah Torah, and also Rav Moshe Chaim Lozatto, they both discussed this at great length, that they say the following. The purpose of the human being is to establish a relationship with God, to have a relationship with our Creator. A relationship with anyone, with anything, requires a certain compatibility, requires a certain similarity. To have a relationship with God requires that we be similar to God. Domeh, similar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To become similar to God requires imitation of God. And the Rambam says, Maimonides says, the majority of the commandments are indeed all designed to teach us how to imitate our Creator, how to be God-like. As the Medrash says, Mahu Rakum, Afata Rakum, as He is merciful, you should be merciful. As He is grateful, you should give grace. All the various aspects of the divine midot, the characteristics of God, all the various aspects of divine providence, we are supposed to try to imitate and to be like God. In fact, the etymology of the English word good is from God. It's the idea of the commandments is to teach us how to be God-like, how to be good, and how to imitate God and to be compatible with Him so that we can have a relationship. As he says, the person is obligated to walk in the ways of Hashem and to imitate Him. In academies, it's what we call imitatio Dei, to imitate God. So that's the third purpose of the commandment, is to establish a relationship with God by becoming God-like, similar to God, through being good, through acting and walking in His ways. And number four, from the Tikkuni Zohar, points out that the name of God in the world is revealed and is concealed. It's a little bit of both. Obviously, the name of God is not totally revealed in the world. If it would be, we wouldn't have room for free will. A few months ago, we had a meteor shower in Israel. The Leonid meteor shower happens at once every 33 years. So at 4:10 a.m. in the morning, I woke up my kids, and we went onto the roof of our apartment building, and we all lay back on the tar and looked up at the sky. It was absolutely amazing. Thousands of streaks of meteorites going across the sky. Absolutely amazing thing. We said a bracha, and we looked at it. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, as we say the bracha, to recognize that this is the works of God, this is a part of the creation of Hashem, the wisdom of the Creator, you have to realize also that it's not obvious. It's not as if one of the meteorites goes off on the side and writes Hashem. And then you can look at it and say, notice God's use of color in the bottom right-hand corner there, right? That's not how it is. The name of God is concealed in the world. You have to find it. Free will. It's not totally concealed. If it was totally concealed, we wouldn't have a chance of finding it. But it's not totally revealed, because then we wouldn't have a purpose here. So it's half concealed and half revealed. And the purpose of the mitzvot is indeed to engage in the revelation of God in the world. I once spoke at University of California in Santa Barbara, and a student came into the room before I started speaking. I was talking to the students. I asked him what he was majoring in. And he said, like something between religion and philosophy. I said, could you be more specific? He said, yeah, I could. I said, well, go ahead. And he said, I'm majoring in revelation. He's actually majoring in revelation. Isn't this state a great country? No. So now, what? I don't know what you do with a degree in revelation, but in any case, the Baal Shem Tov says that you can learn from everyone, and you can learn from everything. And I learned from him, indeed, every Jew is meant to be also majoring in revelation. That's what our major is in life. When I do an act of altruistic kindness, pretty rare, but when I do that, right, that's a revelation of the image of God in the human being. When a person does an act of cruelty, when a person acts, in, we call it in English, inhuman, that is a concealment of the divine presence. There are people who spend their lives concealing the divine presence in the human being, concealing the divine presence in the world. And there are people who, when you look at them, you say, there goes someone created in the image of God, the Tzelem Elohim. And the purpose of the mitzvot also is to reveal godliness in every aspect of creation, every aspect of time, every aspect of space, and obviously the image of God in the human being. So that's the other purpose. The mitzvah is that which reveals God in the world, reveals God in the human being. So that is those are the four major purposes of the commandments. Refinement of humanity, as the Midrash says, instilling within us consciousness and thought as opposed to instinct and gut reaction, autopilot. Number three is imitation of God being a good person, walking in his ways. And number four is revelation of godliness within the human being and within the world. But now, to the more sticky question, how is it that the details of the commandments accomplish this? How do these nitpicking details embodied in the vast codes of Jewish law, in the Talmud, etc., how does this apparent hair splitting have anything to do with being good, with imitating God, with revelation? How do they work? So if you have a look at the second part, methodology of the mitzvot. A, in order to be a good person, I think it is agreed upon by moral philosophers that you require at least two components. You have to be committed to that which is good, And you have to act consistently with that commitment. You have to be committed to that which is good, and you have to act consistently. Now, this may sound obvious, but there are many examples, counter-examples of this, of people who are committed but not consistent, consistent but not committed. For example, anyone been to Singapore? So in Singapore, on the roofs of commercial vehicles, there are little lights attached. Lights. And the lights are attached to the speedometer. And when the car goes over the speed limit, the light starts flashing and the police pick them up. Isn't that great? Now, I think you're doing that in Israel, but they figured the country and stuff looking like a disco, you know, like flashing lights all over. So, in any case, you see, a person could be a person living in Singapore might be a wonderful law-abiding citizen, may drive safely and not jaywalk and not litter because there's serious fines and penalties for things like that. But it doesn't mean that he's necessarily moral. I mean, I've had four students in Singapore, they're all wonderful people. But it doesn't necessarily, the fact that someone is law-abiding in Singapore doesn't mean they're morally committed. It's just you can't get away with it. You cannot get away with anything else. So the person may be consistent, but not committed. Maybe the person has been given a push by their school or parents, and they're still struggling on inertia for a certain amount of time. So they act consistently, but they're not really deep down committed. So you can have consistency without commitment. Not good. Not enough. And you can also have commitment without consistency. That's very common. People have commitment, and they really do believe in certain ideals, but they don't always act consistently. For example, you get a phone call from the principal at the school. It says, your son's been suspended for the day. My son? That's right, he was caught cheating on his exam. What's most parents' reaction going to be? My son? The Sadiq, the Gaon? He's such a genius, he doesn't need to cheat. And even if he needed to cheat, he's such a righteous person, he wouldn't cheat. So the principal says, we have evidence. She says, evidence? What evidence? He says, the answer in his exam was exactly the same as the answers in the exam of the boy sitting right next to him. So what's your reaction going to be? The boy next to him, the son of Satan, right? He cheated for my son. So the principal says, I have further evidence. He says, what's here? He says, very simple. He says, question number 19, the boy sitting next to your son wrote, the answer, I don't know. Question number 19, your son wrote, I don't know either. So now, obviously, when the son comes home from school, the father says, sit down. Sit down to study. And you know, parents have this filing cabinet of lectures they give to kids, right? A, adulthood, C, car, you know, D, drugs, dating, right, etc. So he gets the honesty lecture out. He starts giving the kid about the truth, honesty, integrity, right, the way of life in our family. And he's giving the kid the lecture. As he gives the lecture, the phone rings. His wife answers the phone. Says, hello, Mr. Goldberg? The father is saying, just a minute, son, we're in the middle of honesty. I'm not home. He says, I'm sorry, he's not home. On the cellular? No. He says, I'm sorry, he's in Tierra del Fuego. That's right. The cellular service has not reached there, no. So now he says, where were we, son? I guess, honesty. Now you see, this guy, I think, deep down he believes that honesty and truth are good values. But not when Goldberg's on the phone. You know, so he's not consistent. How easy is it to be consistent? We have 10, you know, the Nachmanides says that all 613 commandments can be derived from the 10, Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 principles, what's called the 10 commandments, the book, not the movie. So all 613 can be derived from these 10 principles. So Nachmanides, I think, is telling us a very important idea. What we want to do is we want to be consistent with 10 principles. How easy is it for thousands, millions of people over thousands of years to act consistently with 10 principles? I want to give you an example. Let's take one principle, and let's see how easy is it to act consistently with that principle. The principle I'm going to choose is, I've decided that I do not want to benefit from the suffering of animals. Therefore, from today on, I will not benefit from the suffering of an animal. That sounds like a simple principle. I cancel the hunting trip tomorrow. Fairly simple, right? So now let's try and track moral decisions I have to make relevant to that principle throughout the day. So you wake up in the morning, what's the first decision you have to make? Before even what to wear, What type of cosmetics do I use? Do I use the toothpaste which has been tested on rabbits in some warehouse in Philadelphia, right? We've got thousands of rabbits with toothbrushes. Is that what I do? Or do I go for the, you know, non-animal tested toothpaste? First question. Right, the next question I have to do is, do I wear my leather shoes? True, the animal right now is dead, but am I not benefiting from the suffering of an animal by wearing leather? What would you say? Is it correct to wear leather or not? If you don't want to benefit from the suffering of an animal, I would say that it's wrong to wear leather. So you have to make a decision about that. So you say, no leather shoes, I put on my canvas shoes, canvas belt. The next decision I have to make is breakfast. So I say, okay, I go to a restaurant, ask the waiter, what's good for breakfast? You know, and we're September in Australia, and the waiter says to me, steak and egg. Common breakfast in Australia. So, steak and egg. I look at him, and I say, excuse me, I don't believe that one is allowed to benefit from the suffering of an animal. I do not want your steak. So the waiter says, no, you don't understand, sir. No, all the meat in our restaurant comes from the Happy Valley Ranch. I say, what? That's right. He brings out a brochure. The Happy Valley Ranch is a ranch where there are no fences or barbed wire. The cows are free to roam anywhere they want. They can eat all types of grasses and herbs. They get a shiatsu massage every day. These are the happiest cows in the world. And every now and again, one of the cows dies. We take it and we cut it up into steaks, and here it is. So is it consistent for me to eat this steak or not? Did the animal suffer to provide it? No. So I decide this is unbelievable, this is a stupendous occasion. So I say, look mate, give me a few kilos, fill an Esky with it, right? I go home, right, I put the skimmer on in the pool, invite some friends over, put some Fosters in the fridge, and I've got a barbecue on, right? And this is a course of celebration, mate, right? So I've got the mesquite wood and the barbecue, I'm poking around the steaks, and I think to myself, just a minute, what is the neighbour going to think when he smells steak on my barbecue? Surely, if I am concerned that animals should not suffer for humans, is it not appropriate that I should worry about the impact of my actions on others? If he smells the steak, what's he going to think? You know what he's going to think? Becker is a hypocrite. And he's not going to take my moral message. So even if I go to him and convince him, I say, look, Bob, look at that steak. Look at the happiness oozing out of that steak. That's from the Happy Valley Ranch. Let's say he believes me. What about a person walking by on the street? He smells the steak. What does he want to do? Have a steak? This is what we call maris ayin, by the way, in Jewish law. I have to be concerned about the impact of my actions morally on other people. So I decide no steak. I then go to the store and I say, okay, I'll get dairy food. So I get dairy food. There's a fellow standing next to me in an animal rights t-shirt with a wild look in his eye. And he says, you like dairy food, huh? I said, no, but I don't believe that animals should suffer for humans. I don't eat meat. And he says, and you think dairy food's okay? I say, well, isn't it? He says, what do you mean? He says, what about cows in the wild? Hard to imagine, right? But herds of cows running through the jungles of Bolivia, trampling piranha fish, whatever, I don't know. So, but again, the truth is, modern-day domestic cows have never lived in the wild. They were descended from the aurochs, which was bred by people in Europe thousands of years ago. But anyway, leave that aside. He doesn't know much about bovine history. But, so he says, what about cows in the wild? I said, what do you mean? He says, well, cows in the wild, do they give lots of milk? I said, well, don't they? I don't know. He says, no, he says, they give milk when the calf needs milk. The calf nurses from the mother. When the mother stops nursing, when the calf stops nursing, the mother stops giving milk. That's the end. He says, the cows are captured. He says, the calf is over there in the veal section of the freezer. He says, so if you think you're such a righteous person by only having dairy food, think again, buddy boy. And he throws a bucket of milk on me. So now, oh, it's better than blood, but anyway. So now, is he right? Is he right? Is it correct? Morally, am I inconsistent if I have milk or not? On the one hand, these cows have been in captivity for thousands of years. They could not survive in the wild. On the other hand, they are suffering, and I am benefiting from their suffering. Is it right? Is it wrong? It's a question. So I decide, you know what? I'll be machmir. I'll be stringent. I want to be consistent. So I go to the health food section. Tofu, nori, fermented tofu, fermented nori, etc. Right? The type of diet where you don't actually live longer, it just feels like you're living a lot longer. So I look in there and I see I'm quite hungry at this point, so I see a granola bar. And I take this granola bar and I say to myself, well, hey, I mean, you can't fit a cow in a granola bar, so it must be okay. A power bar. And then I look at the ingredients, and I see in the ingredients we've got glycerides, which can come from animal fat. And it's got natural flavouring, which can come from civet, from one of the mammal. And I look at this and I say, oh my gosh, not only that, but it's got gelatin made from animal bones, it's got red food colouring made from cochineal beetle extract, right? It has got, I mean, this bar is a veritable abattoir, right? So then I think to myself, but according to the FDA regulations, since it's listed as a vegetable product, that means the amount of animal content must be less than 2%. So I say 2% is not much. Lost 2% between friends. But then I think to myself, Pfeiffer's Handbook of Physiology says the average taste threshold of a person is about 1.64%, that 1 in 60. Which means that if it's over 1.6, over 1 in 60, and it's less than 2%, that means these tastes are discernible. Which means I cannot ignore them. You may have heard of the principle of before precision. So, few hours. Imagine, let's amplify that. For millions of Jews, over thousands of years in every single part of the world. What do you need to do to be consistent with those 10 principles? I'll tell you what you have to do. You have to write the Babylonian Talmud. That's what halacha is. Jewish law is nothing less than consistency with principles given on Sinai. If you want to be consistent with these principles, you've got to follow halacha. That's what halacha is about. And it will direct you. It will say, yes, do you have to worry about the impact on another person at this point? Do you have to worry about the fact that this was produced by a sin, Mitzvah Habava Avera, for example? Are you allowed to get benefit from this thing, Isra of Hanah? Do you have to worry about what quantities you have to worry about? This is all halacha. This is a simple principle. Take something like don't steal, don't murder. These are principles which, when put into practice in society, are very, very difficult to be consistent about. Stealing, all of business ethics, all of the ideas of jurisprudence, honesty, all these ideas are all to be consistent with one principle, thou shalt not steal. Not easy. That's what halacha is all about. That's what all the details are about. That's what the Gemara, the Talmud is about. It is trying to figure out how we can be completely and totally consistent with these moral principles. B, living law. The Torah is a living law. That means it has to apply to all situations. In order for us to be attached to meaning, doesn't only mean Saturday morning in synagogue. It doesn't only mean in Yom Kippur. It means that every time of life, in every situation. We believe that there is moral instruction and spiritual purpose in every single activity that we do. There is nothing which is devoid of morality. There's nothing which is devoid of spirituality. The question is trying to find it and bring it out. And that's what the halakha is about. It's a living law. It has to apply to all times, all situations, all places. Rav Shiller, the Rosh Yeshiva of Rosh Hashanah, told me that when he was once in Brooklyn College, sociology course, he was the only student in his class with a yarmulke. And the professor at the beginning of the class said, you with the yarmulke, what's your name? He said, Shiller. He said, are you a student of the Talmud? Rav Shiller said, yes. He said, in that case, I have nothing to teach you. You're dismissed. Rav Shiller was a little stunned, and he said, excuse me, sir? He said, that's right. The Talmudists were the greatest sociologists of all time. They created a high quality of life for Jews in every conceivable socioeconomic and geopolitical circumstance known. I have nothing to teach you. Rav Shiller said, thank you, sir, but I didn't come here to learn anything. I just need 2 credits. But that's another aspect of the many, many commandments. When you think about the amount of moral situations that we encounter in life, when you think about all the decisions we have to make in life, 613 is a very small amount. Think of all the decisions and all the situations of all of society, of all the Jews that ever lived, of every conceivable situation Jews have encountered. 613 commandments is a tiny amount. But they are able to give a living law that has guidance in every situation. If you look through the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, you will find that he has guidance in philosophy, he has laws of prayer, he has laws of combat morality, he has laws of the kingdom, laws of jurisprudence, business ethics, every conceivable conceivable, sexual ethic, every conceivable situation, all covered by Jewish law. C, to make us aware of the spiritual side of life, regular prayer, blessings, we make a bracha. We have a mezuzah on the door. What are these for? They remind us that we're here for a purpose. When I make a bracha, reminds me I'm here for a purpose. I was on a plane once from Detroit to Seattle. Sitting two seats from me was a non-Jewish woman. I could tell she had a large crucifix. And it was a fairly empty flight. And my ears are not adjusted to the altitude. So I got my kosher food first, which they serve first in order to exacerbate anti-Semitism. And I made a blessing. I made a bracha. I said, Baruch Atah Hashem, Mekanim Elchoy, Lom Shachon, Li Bevoroi. About that level of sound. That was the blessing you make on unidentifiable food. So she said to me, said, excuse me? And I said, my ears had popped because I started cheering. I said, I wasn't talking to you. She said, well, who are you talking to? There's no one else around. I said, oh, the blessing. Oh, I was talking to God. And I mentioned, and it, you know, really, because a lot of time I've been doing it by rote, and it's good to have a person remind you of why you're saying a blessing. And I explained to her, one of the purposes of a blessing is to remind me, why am I eating? Why am I alive? What am I doing with my life? Purpose. Mezuzah. You think of the mezuzah, monotheism, love of God, the commandments, reward and punishment, divine providence, the land of Israel, all in the mezuzah, Exodus, all from the position. It's all there, right? All in the mezuzah. Reminder. Rituals, D, as behavior modification techniques. We believe the best way to affect the inner person is by the actions, as the Sefer HaChinuch says. I'll give you some examples of dietary laws, kashrut. Discipline. Discipline. It's the idea of instilling us. I remember, you know, have you ever been in the supermarket, right, at the checkout counter, right, with a little child? Horrific. Right, you're in the line that says express, 8 items. There's a person in front of you with 25 items. She's trying to cash a third-party check from Guatemala in Thai baht. Right? And your kid's standing there, oh, blah, surrounded by candy. Oh, can I have one of those? Can I have one of those? May I please have one? Right, yeah, and my kid would say, oh, please give me one of those. If you don't, I'll throw myself on the ground, go hysterical. Right? Embarrass you, you'll eventually hit me. Someone's going to call a social worker and the police and stuff. Isn't it cheaper to buy me a 25-cent bar? So I was in Toronto at the supermarket in exactly this situation. My five-year-old was with me, five-year-old son at the time, Avram Shimon, and we're exactly in this situation. He's getting very antsy, and he says, Abba, can I have one of those? May I please have one of those? No, please have one of those? No. Right? So he says, Abba, one of those. So I take it off, and I have a look at it, and I say, Avram Shimon, it's not kosher. You know what his reaction was? Oh. That was it. That's amazing. And I thought to myself, my five-year-old son has more self-discipline than most adults in the Western world. Tell an adult in the Western world, no, you cannot have this pleasure. What will they say? I won't get caught. I won't do it regularly. I won't get addicted. I'll do it quite blah, 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 blah. Right? No is not in the vocabulary. Kashrut, self-discipline. Charity, when you give, you become a giver. It's the act of giving. Even clothing, the clothing you wear. When I do reserve duty in the Israeli army, I'm a chaplain in the Israeli army, I put on my uniform, I feel myself growing. Right? By the time I've got the boots on and everything, I feel like I'm Rabbi Rambo. You know, we're serious. You know, like, point me in the direction. Right? So, truth is what I mainly do is supervise kashrut, but leaving that aside. But again, the clothing that you wear affects how you think of yourself. It affects how others think of you as well. I have a friend, a minor actor in New York, who you may have seen him, he was floating near the funnel in Titanic. He's one of the... Anyway, so he's Irish Catholic, and he was dressed as a Cossack acting in a movie, right? And he walks, you know, during a break in filming, he goes into a deli, and he asks for the, give me a, you know, ham on rye. And the owner of the delicatessen, the Italian, says, no. He says, what do you mean, no, it's a free country, give me the ham on rye. And the Italian says, no, you want to go to heck? You do it yourself, I'm not going to help you. So obviously, you know, the way you dress affects how others look at you as well. I'm going to skip these because I've been told I only have 1 minute. So we're going to get to the end, F. Halakha also is designed to have us focus on obligation. There are many mitzvot, because the many mitzvot are designed to have us thinking not in terms of what I deserve, but in terms of what I owe. There's a very beautiful midrash, and I'll end with this. The midrash Rabbah in Parshas Noah talks about Alexander of Macedon. Alexander of Macedon He goes to North Africa and he visits an African king. He conquered it next summer, that way summer he was on vacation. And he sits with the king, and before the king, a court case. One guy says, look, I bought a field from this guy. He says, as I was ploughing the field, my plough hit something and it turned out to be a box of money. He says, so I believe that he must have forgotten it in the field and I'd like him to have it back. And the other guy saying, look, I sold you a field and everything in it. The money is yours, you take it. Now Alexander is sitting there in a state of shock. So the king says, well, the second says, do you have a son? The guy says, yeah. How old is he? He says, 18. Says the other guy, you got a daughter? He says, yeah. How old is she? 17. Says, right, by virtue of the power invested in me by me, I hereby declare the children betrothed, and the money goes to their wedding. And they hug and muzzle for muzzle for they all live, you know, live happily ever after. I don't know about the kids, but the parents are happy, that's the main thing. So Alexander is in a state of shock. The African king asks Alexander, what's going on? Alexander says, such a thing would never happen in my country. A guy would find money, he'd take it, and that'd be the end. And here he'd also sue for damage to the plough. So the African king asks Alexander, says, so what would you have said? Alexander said, simple. I would have killed them both and taken the money from my treasury. So the African asks Alexander, he says, does the sun rise and set every day in your country? He says, yes. Does it rain in your country? Alexander says, yes. He thinks for a while, he says, you know what, it must be in the merits of the animals, because the humans where you live obviously don't deserve it. Very beautiful Midrash, and I think what it's saying is this. In the Jewish system represented by this African country, the Jewish system is a focus on what's my obligation. I found something in my field, it's my obligation to return it to its rightful owner. I signed the contract, it's my obligation to fulfill the contract. The king is thinking, I'm the king, it's my obligation to have my subjects live in harmony. In Alexander's country, in the Greek system, and to a great degree Western society has inherited this, how do we think? I found it in my field, it's my right to keep it. I left it in my field, it's my right to get it back, and the king is saying, I am the king, it's my right to do anything I want. The mitzvahs tell us, don't focus on what I can get, what I deserve, what I want, focus on what I can give, what I owe, and what I can do. And in fact, to paraphrase your great leader, John F. Kennedy, he said in his inauguration speech, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. The mitzvahs are telling us, ask not what others can do for you, ask what you can do for others. Thank you very much.